We are going to be studying the tractate of Chulin, and the first part of what I would like to do is to put the tractate itself in a certain context, but first to again define the terms. We are going to study Chulin. That is available in the Art Scroll edition of the Talmud. The Art Scroll edition of the Talmud is in many, many volumed editions over there. Those 3.5 shelves are filled with the different editions of the Art Scroll. Art Scroll is a first-rate English translation with a very good explanation. And the tractate of Chulin is actually a very large tractate. It is not the biggest, but one of the biggest of our tractates on the Talmud. And in fact, in the published form in Art Scroll, it's 3 volumes. I don't know how much of it we will actually get through, but I will skip around. I will indeed skip around. But for the time being, we'll stick to volume 1. It's just too much of an outlay to get involved with all of the volumes, although I do want to also look at some of the other material, and you'll see very shortly the kind of material that's covered in the tractate of Chulin. So we will start with chapter 1 of Chulin, and we will for a while just get started and keep going with it. As those of you who have been through this before know, when you start with Talmud, you never know where you're going to end up. To some extent, the topic defines the subject, but to some extent, again, you just don't know where it's going. Part of the time we'll be spending really on logic, on issues of how the subject is analyzed, let alone what the end result is. Because in Talmud, sometimes the end result is less important than how you get there, or where you travel on the way till you get to the end result. Now, the Talmud is one piece of our tradition of law, which really has two pieces to it. Just some of this is review for those of you who are already familiar with it, but I won't dwell on it for a long time. The law is divided really into two aspects. One is the written law, the other is the oral law. Written law you have in the Torah. And so one of the things that I want to do with you tonight is to look at sources in the Torah that define some of the parameters of the laws of Kashrut. At the same time, much of the law is not, either it's not there in the Torah, or it's not so obvious that it's there. That is the realm of the oral law. The oral law, that is to say, either commentary on the law or understandings of the law that are considered by the rabbis themselves to go back to the very period of the written law itself. The assumption, as it's stated classically, is that Moses received the Torah on Mount Sinai, and when he received it, it came together with the Berush, with an explanatory oral aspect to it. Now, to some extent, that's always true in any legal system. If you have a period when the legal system begins, it doesn't begin in a vacuum. It begins in a context. It's true in American constitutional law. If you can define what the Constitution is, still one of the interesting things that you will want to do is to try and understand the context in which it grows, or in which it first happened. And that's true here in Jewish law as well. The oral law is really quite massive. It's much bigger than the written law. And the source for the oral law is the Talmud. The Talmud contains that oral law. The Talmud, actually, in its historical development, is made up of two parts. The first part, the Mishnah. Mishnah is edited in roughly the year 200 CE. 200 CE by Rabbi Judah the Prince. And the Mishnah sets forth the basic structure and contents of the law. Once that is done, it is commented on, and those comments are eventually assembled by roughly the year 500, although, frankly, for the next few hundred years, there's an editing process that goes on. And that was called specifically Gemara. So there is Mishnah, and there is Gemara. Talmud itself, any volume of the Talmud, is made up first of the Mishnah, and then of the Gemara. Gemara, which is more or less commentary on the Mishnah. When I say more or less, some of it just may be put in there by the editor because there are materials that are somehow associated with the subject, or it may even be that just the editor found certain subjects interesting. But that's the basic structure of things. Now, in the Mishnah, Mishnah is made up of six orders, six sedarim. Okay? The seder is the formulaic structure of the Mishnah. There are six of them, six orders. They cover a great deal of ground, all the areas of the law. First one, for example, is Zera'im. Zera'im literally means seeds. And that covers all of the areas of the agricultural laws. Because the law frequently will refer, the Torah will refer to the land of Israel, to crops that are grown in the land of Israel, and to disposition of those crops, to tithes that have to be taken from those crops, to tzedakah, to corners of the field that have to be set aside from those crops. All of that is found in the order of Zera'im. Second order is Mo'ed. Mo'ed. Mo'ed literally means sacred times. And so in the order of Mo'ed you will have all of the ritual law pertaining to the festivals of the year, including the Sabbath. Okay? So, from a practical perspective, frankly, the laws of Zera'im were studied in the land of Israel because they were particularly relevant. First of the tractates of Zera'im is actually a little bit anomalous. It's Brachot. Brachot are blessings. And in fact, brachot is associated with that because you make blessings, among other things, over food. Your food blessings. Hamotzi lecha min ha'aretz. So it was associated with Zera'im. The Talmud itself, this combination of Mishnah and Gemara, is edited in Babylonia in roughly the year 500. Babylonia. The Jewish community, remember, is exiled to Babylonia after the first destruction, 586 BCE, destruction of the first temple. And the community establishes itself there in Babylonia and maintains itself fairly much in perpetuity until about the early 1950s. It's only in modern times that the Jews are really no longer living in Babylonia. It's after the founding of the State of Israel and the fact that the Iraqis kicked out the Jewish community at that point. But the Jewish community had been there longer than the Arabs, by 1,000 years. So this phenomenon of the Babylonian Talmud, that which is edited in Babylonia, to some extent reflects Babylonian reality, namely, the only tractate of Gemara that we find in Zera'im is the tractate of Brachot. Because frankly, the laws having to do with agriculture of the land of Israel, which is not relevant. They were not relevant, so we don't find them. But that's fairly rare as far as a lacuna goes, that you're missing material. Moed, the sacred times of the year, are relevant no matter where Jews are. Okay? So you've got everything involved in Moed. The next one is Nashim. Nashim, literally women. Those are all the laws of marriage. Everything relating to marriage. Starting the largest of the tractates is Yevamot, the levirate marriage, the usual kind of marital arrangement which you have in the Bible. And the laws of Kiddushin, we studied that here, did 2 years on Kiddushin. The laws of divorce, all of that is in Nashim. Okay? Next tractate is Nizikin. Next order is Nizikin. Nizikin, we've studied last year. We did Baba Metzia. Baba Metzia, we were studying economic law, the laws of economics. And that deals with ethics in the marketplace. And that is in the order of Nizikin. Okay? The next section, now we're now down, we've got four, we've got two left. Okay, we've got six orders. We've got two left. The final two are Kodoshim and Toharot. Kodoshim involves those tractates which are relevant to the sacrificial system. Okay? Sacrificial tractates. Literally, kodoshim are holy objects. And the offerings themselves that were brought in the temple were called kodoshim. They are kodoshim. So, order number 5 involves temple sacrifice. And you know from reading the Bible that a fair amount of space is taken up in the Chumash with the sacrificial system. Just to move quickly ahead to the last of the orders, Toharot, purity. Subject of ritual purity and impurity is also a basic subject that is dealt with again and again in the Torah. There are concepts of Tuma and Tohora, ritual impurity and purity. And in order to enter the sacred space, namely the temple in Jerusalem, one had to be tahor as opposed to tameh. Tahor, ritually pure, as opposed to tameh, impure. Now, once the temple was destroyed, the laws of taharot really lost a lot of their practical applications, except in one particular area. And that is the area of nida, of women's menstruation. Because menstruation continues whether you have a temple or not. And the laws in the Torah not only speak of menstruation in terms of the fact that menstrual blood produces ritual impurity, but in addition to that, it makes a woman forbidden to her husband until a certain amount of time passes, and then she has to undergo a process of becoming tahor, tahora. She has to go to the mikveh. Now those laws remain until today. They are, because of the way they are formulated, that they are formulated not only in terms of the temple, but in terms of prohibition of sexual relations, and sexual relations go on until today. I don't know what will happen in the future. These days, we used to teach medical ethics in the seminary, and I found that the only thing the students were interested in was weird kinds of conception. This is what the students were interested in. Conception, you know, first it was test tube babies in those days. I just got the Nobel Prize for that. So, you know, for a while it was really hot stuff, test tube babies, all these kinds of odd things. Reproduction without a sperm, you know, very odd things. So I said to them one day, I said, "You're interested, aren't you interested in the old-fashioned method?" And the truth is that they had forgotten that the old-fashioned method was connected with reproduction. That has to do with the students today. Young people are very aware of sex as a form of pleasure, but not really particularly aware of it as a way of propagating, because propagation just doesn't fit into the picture of where their minds are. Nonetheless, that is the order of Toharot. In the Bavli, in the Babylonian Talmud, there is only one tractate that has Gemara, and that is the tractate of Nidah, the tractate about menstruation. Okay? There are numerous tractates of the Mishnah. Remember, the Mishnah is produced in the land of Israel in the year 200. Right? In the land of Israel in the year 200, the temple is destroyed in the year 70, so that's 130 years after the destruction of the temple. All of these things in the land of Israel were dealt with. One of the purposes, undoubtedly, of the Mishnah was to preserve tradition. Many of the later rabbis make that note, that part of the purpose of the Mishnah is to preserve tradition. Realize in those times tradition was under fire, largely from the Romans. It was Roman occupation. Romans were a cosmopolitan people, but they had no interest in the Jews per se, in terms of their own culture. The Jews were a rather difficult group of people to rule, and rather by the period that we're talking about, the period of the Mishnah, frankly in the 70 years before, around the year 130, the Roman revolt had taken, the Jewish revolt against the Romans had taken place, the revolt of Bar Kokhba, and the Romans simply put down that revolt with all the strength and the power that they had in the Roman Empire. So there was no love lost between the Romans and the Jews. The Jews to this day, and it's kind of interesting when you take a trip to Rome and you see the Rome, if you study the Talmud, and the Rome is just the bottom of the barrel. Although the Talmud does have some admiring words to say every once in a while about Rome. The Romans built good bridges. They were technologically a very superior civilization. That's appreciated in the Talmud. But the rest of that civilization was from hunger. Now, I went to the end, to Taharot. That was the sixth of the orders. I want to go back one, which is back to Kodoshim. Kodoshim is a huge order of the Mishnah. Interestingly enough, it's a huge order also of Gemarot. Exactly why that is, my own speculation goes along the lines of, and because the temple had been destroyed. So it's not as if this was really extremely practical material. The first of the tractates, for example, the tractate of Zevachim, a Zevach, is an offering, a slaughtered animal, the slaughtering of animals. But slaughtering of animals, not as we're going to talk about them, but slaughtering of animals specifically for the purpose of the bringing an offering in the temple. It's a huge masechet, absolutely huge, huge. Part of the purpose of that, I'm sure, was to keep all of the remembrances of the temple and its procedures alive. If you couldn't function because of the Romans, there is a way that you can function intellectually. Intellectually, you can set down your traditions, you can remember what things were like, and you can therefore preserve them for potential restoration. So much so that actually in our own time, the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, it was the order of Kodashim that became, among one piece of religious Zionism, the premier text that was studied. The Chofetz Chaim, for example, in Lithuania, was one of those who felt that what had to be studied was the laws of Kodashim. Rav Kook in the land of Israel, Avraham Yitzchak and Kohen Cook, the first chief rabbi of the land of Israel, decided with the Chofetz Chaim that they had to study the laws of Kodashim. And the reason for that was because of the restoration, that Zionism itself was part of the process of the restoration. And we know what all of that is because we have these tractates of atonement. And it's accessible. The whole thing is really relatively accessible. So the first of the tractates of Kodashim is Zivachim, the offerings themselves, the animal offerings. The second tractate of Kodashim is Menachot, grain offerings. And the Zivachim themselves the first tractate, this tractate of Zivachim, was, most scholars say, originally known as Shchitat Zivachim. You know the word Shchita, it's ritual slaughter. So Shchitat Zivachim, just to put it in the context, referred first in the discussion of these issues in the Talmud to ritual slaughter, not of the kind that we know, but ritual slaughter in the context of the temple. Okay? You bring an offering to the temple, and that offering has to be slaughtered. Interestingly enough, not only Kohanim are permitted to do that slaughter. Most people assume that it's a Kohanic function to slaughter the animals. That's not true. Anybody was allowed to slaughter. Anybody. And it's very interesting to note, women as well as men were allowed to slaughter in the temple. Okay? So, that was the major subject of Zivachim. Then comes Menachot, which are the grain offerings. Those are another piece of the sacrificial system. There are offerings of grain, of bread, we call them bagels. All kinds of cooked grains were offered, and it's all in the Torah. But the details exactly of how this was done, you find now in the tractate of Menachot. Okay. Also a very large tractate of the Talmud. The third tractate of Kodashim is the tractate of Chulin. Chulin is literally Shchitat Chulin. It is the slaughter of not Kodashim. Kodashim are animals that are used for sacrificial purposes. They are Kodesh. They are sanctified. And the sanctification of the animal, the setting aside of the animal for the purpose of the offering in God's space, is essential to the notion of Kodesh, of something that is holy. Okay? In contrast to that is our tractate, which is Shchitat Chulin. We have these two opposed phrases of Kodesh and Chol. Kodesh is holy. Chol we normally translate as the profane or the regular, the normal. When you make Havdalah, for example, the prayer of Havdalah at the end of Shabbat is Hamabdil Bein Kodesh L'Chol. God who creates a separation between Kodesh, the holy, and the Chol, and the profane, as it were. But profane, not in the way we use it in English. Profane has a pejorative sense in English. It just means non-holy, as it were. Okay? So there, it's in terms of time. There's holy time, and there's regular time. That's in Haftalah. But in the order of Kodashim, there are holy animals and there are regular animals. holy animals and there are regular animals. Both of them have to be slaughtered. Both of them have to be slaughtered in order to be used. And therefore, the tractate of Chulin is that tractate that is devoted, first of all, in terms of its subject matter, to the subject of normal slaughter, which is to say slaughtering that is not related to the offering of animals in the temple. Okay? Now, both of those slaughters, as we will see, they're not really very different. They're a little bit different. There are a few differences between them. But Shechita itself, therefore, really has its origin within the temple precincts, and that's important for a few reasons, one of which is conceptual, that the idea of slaughter itself goes back to the giving of an offering. Okay? And the part of, there are a wide variety of offerings. A part of the offering was given to the Kohanim. If you brought just an offering, let's say you brought what's called a shlamim, a free will offering, came to the temple, you brought a shlamim. That's an offering that's not obligatory. What's an obligatory offering? An obligatory offering is something like you transgressed a sin, right? You transgressed the law of the Torah. And you want to ask forgiveness for the transgression of the law of the Torah. The Yom Kippur type of thing. Okay? For that, you would have to bring a sin offering. A sin offering. So, that's an obligatory offering. You bring that offering, and in fact, the offering itself is eaten by the Kohanim. It's their food. It's their food. However, the blood is taken from the animal and the blood is offered on the altar itself. There are also some pieces of the animal that are offered on the altar. They're not eaten. They're not eaten. The majority of the animal is eaten by the Kohanim. That's a sin offering. Okay? A shlamim. If you bring a shlamim, you go to Jerusalem, you've had a good year, you want to thank God. So you bring a todah offering. Todah, say todah, thank you. You bring an offering. You go up to the Temple Mount, and either you slaughter it, or you ask the Kohen to slaughter it for you. Okay? Then the blood, again, is taken. Blood is placed on the altar. You can't eat blood. Torah forbids it. Blood is given to God. The rest of the offering, a small piece of it is also burned. A piece of it goes to the Kohanim, and then you get the rest of it. Okay, essentially, you eat most of the animal. Now, this may seem rather gross, but in fact, the consumption of meat is a very natural thing. Frankly, it's still a natural thing. The only thing that's not natural is the food emporium. We now, for the very first time, probably in all of history, sort of get things through production methods, and we don't see what goes on. Even I'm not that old. I seem a little bit ancient to the Hebrew school kids, but to you I'm probably not as ancient as I am to them. I remember when I was a kid, I would go with my grandmother in Brooklyn, and we would go to places, almost, you know, around the corner, where there were live chickens. There were live chickens. You wouldn't buy a dead chicken. Who would ever buy a dead chicken? Dead chicken is disgusting. My grandmother would only buy a live chicken. Not only a live chicken, she would look. She'd take a look at the chicken first. She had an eye. She knew what kind of chicken she wanted. What is a healthy chicken? What would taste good and what wouldn't taste good? She would never cook for her family a chicken that wasn't a good chicken. You'd pick out the chicken. The guy takes it to the... And the shochet is in the back. And they slaughter the chicken, and you take it home. And of course, you take it home with all the pieces, which would go into whatever she was doing. It was not didn't buy parts. Parts of the chicken. You got all the parts, and you used all the parts. Right? A very economically sound system. But today, you know, we've been, the whole thing has been sanitized. We're sanitized. And I ask kids frequently, well, where does a steak come from? And they say, you know, from the supermarket or from the butcher. And that's where it comes from. Because that's the extent of their experience. A lot of what one reads about, in fact, much of these laws, not all of them, but part of them, laws certainly that have to do with slaughtering, and laws that have to do with animal anatomy, are these days best known by butchers. If any of you have had any experience in a butcher shop, and that too is something that hardly anyone has any experience with anymore, because it's out there. It's not something that we have in our normal purview. Butchers deal with things like this. It used to be, and there probably still are housewives, as far as I know, there are no house husbands who do this, who get to know the butchers, develop relationships with them, know the cuts of meat that they like, ask for certain cuts from the butcher. All of this kind of thing is what you find in Chulin, not in terms of the butcher per se, but in terms of the anatomy of the animal. The anatomy of the animal is a crucial aspect of the slaughter of the animal and the disposition of the parts of the animal. Okay? So all of this is described in Chulin, which is one of the reasons that it's both interesting and very difficult to understand, because most people have no idea of what animal anatomy is. You know, medical students may have in college had to take a comparative anatomy course. So they may take a fish, or they may have felt the inside of a sheep. I can assure you, my grandmother felt them all the time. You know, there was a time when people did that kind of stuff. Butchers do it. That's their profession. They're familiar with animal anatomy. What's good, what's usable, what's not usable. When we read, for example, in an English Bible, the word that's translated S-U-E-T, you have any idea what that is? Right? It's a form of fat. It's a form of fat. It's part of the fat on the inside of the animal. It's the fat that covers certain of the organs of the animal. We will see these things from time to time in the tractate. As a result of some of our technological production, in fact, these days there are some very interesting volumes which are beginning to come out, which are illuminated. This is, for example, a guide to Masechet Chulin, which I'll send around, where you'll be able to, I mean, here's the first, you know.
Vegetarian.
So, this is what it looks like. This is what a cow looks like on the inside. And
you have to look at her.
You need to look in order to know what's going on. Realize that cows have more than one stomach. Okay? Not everybody knows that. Israelis know it. Cows have more than one stomach. There is a technical language for the stomachs of the cow. And all of this technical language is important to learn in order to understand what's going on. There are aspects of the anatomy, such as, for example, the windpipe and the esophagus. In what we will be looking at, we'll even begin it tonight, the windpipe and the esophagus, where they are in the animal, are really very, very crucial, because it is the severance of the windpipe and the esophagus that constitutes the act of shechita. And there is no other way to slaughter an animal, a mammal. There's no other way to slaughter a mammal. Of course, it doesn't pertain to all animals. It does pertain to a lesser degree, but it also pertains to birds, the most common one of which is the chicken. Okay? It does not pertain to two other areas of kosher animals, one of which is grasshoppers. Realize that there are types of grasshoppers that are kosher.
No way.
Yeah, I'm telling you the truth. Yeah. I'm not saying all grasshoppers, but there are grasshoppers that are kosher. Okay? In ancient times, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. They were definitely were consumed. Sure. I am told, I saw the New York Times food section about 2-3 weeks ago, had a whole, was devoted to grasshoppers and other such bugs. And it was, you know, people just waxing ecstatic over the refined taste of these wonderful pieces of food. No. I mean, a lot of calling things. Some of them are permissible and some of them are forbidden. In fact, for practical reasons, we do not eat any grasshoppers because we don't know which are permitted. There was a break in the tradition. We have the same issue, frankly, with birds. We don't know the definition of the birds in the Torah. We think we know them, but we don't really know them. And so our definition of birds, because birds are not described anatomically in the Torah. There's no anatomical description. I'm going to go to the Torah in a short while in order to just see some of the background here. But there's no description of the anatomy of permissible and forbidden birds in the Torah. Yes.
No, we don't know what the
exactly. It says this bird, yes, that bird, no. But unless there is a tradition, we don't know what it means. So we are dependent entirely on the continuity of tradition, and some of those traditions vary. There are Jews who eat geese, and there are Jews who do not eat geese. There are Jews who eat turkey, and there are Jews who will not eat a turkey. Yes? Yep. Now, most do eat a turkey, but there are Jews who refuse to eat a turkey. They say there's no tradition for turkey. There's no tradition. We don't know that it's... We didn't have turkeys, and therefore we don't know what they are. Okay.
This was like the 19th century in Europe. That was the way they celebrated Hanukkah, because it was, had a lot of fat, grease with it, and so expected
what? This... I'm not telling you that turkey is not kosher. I'm just saying that there's a problem in knowing what is kosher as far as birds are concerned. So, but there's one other area that I was getting to. I said that you have to shecht, as we say in Judeo-English. You have to shecht a mammal that is kosher. You have to shecht a kosher bird. You do not have to, there is no shechita for grasshoppers. There's one other area that there's no shechita for fish. Okay? There is no shechita for fish as well. Okay? So, we have to keep that in mind. We'll have to find out why. And you can imagine that the Gemara will ask questions like that. That there are these areas that are left out. They are left out. Of course, you already know now the connection of this system to the temple system, and of course that's not a small thing here. The animals, the mammals that we consume are essentially the mammals, and well, not entirely excuse me, the birds. Some of the birds, like a chicken, for example, was not part of the sacrificial system. The mammals that we eat are all part of the sacrificial system. They're not many. They're essentially the cow and the sheep. The cow and the sheep. And the goat. Well, a goat is considered a sheep. A goat is a form of sheep in the rabbinic type of biology. It's just variants. It's called a seh. And a seh in Hebrew can sometimes refer to a sheep and it can sometimes refer to a goat. So those are the general areas now. We are interested in the tractate of Hulin, in what makes an animal kosher. Now, to begin with, to just step back a little bit, let's remember the written law. And I said we have the written law and the oral law. The laws of kashrut appear in several different places in the Torah. Principal statement of the laws of kashrut is in the book of Leviticus, in the 11th chapter. All right? Parshat Shmini. Parshat Shmini. Now, first of all, what I said simply by locating it in the Torah is really crucial. It's not a small thing that it's located in the book of Leviticus. That should ring a bell with you, because it means that any mention of the laws of kashrut really is together with the laws that pertain to the Levitical rites. And we now also see that that is a part of the structure of the Talmud, that you have the Zevachim first, then you have the Menachot, and then you have Chulin. Okay. So here in the 11th chapter of the book of Leviticus, we have had the first two parshas in Leviticus are essentially sacrificial parshas. Parsha Vayikra and the Parsha of Tzav. Most of the laws of sacrifice are in those first two parshas. Then in the Parsha of Shmini, we see the institution of the sacrificial system, the death of the two sons of Aaron. And therefore you see that this is a very, very dangerous system to begin with, and a highly prescribed system. You can't do it any way you like. You've got to do it the way, or you could lose your life. It's a very dangerous system. That's the nature of Kodesh. Kodesh is separate. Kodesh is set aside. And there is a level of danger to it as well. So among the latter things you find here in chapter 10, you have a description of the way in which the priests should bring their offerings, the fact that they cannot have any wine. And the thought goes that perhaps that's why Nadav and Avihu were cut down, because they had drunk wine before. Here you have the description of that. Then comes chapter 11. Chapter 11. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, these are the living things which you may eat among the beasts that are on the earth. Whatever has a cleft hoof, that parts the hoof, and is a holy cloven, is holy cloven footed, and chews the cud." So it has to have a fully cleft hoof, and it has to chew its cud. That is to say, it has to have more than one, and it has to have a regurgitating stomach system. Okay? "These among the beasts you may eat. Nevertheless, these shall ye not eat of them that only chew the cud, or of them that cheweth the cud but parteth not the hoof." That is to say, if you have only one of those characteristics, it's not enough. You have to have both of them. So it then mentions certain animals that have one of the characteristics. The rock badger, the hare, chews its cud but doesn't have a cleft hoof. Okay? That's rabbits. A rabbit is not a kosher animal. The swine, pigs. Alright? The pig has a cleft hoof, has a fully parted hoof, but chews not its cud. Right? So those are the two characteristics which you have. These may ye eat of all that are in the waters. Right? Now we're going to learn about those things that are in the water. Whatever has fins and scales in the seas and the rivers you may eat. And all that have not fins and scales in the seas and in the rivers, and of all that swarm in the waters, and of all the living creatures that are in the waters, they are a detestable thing unto you. They shall be a detestable thing unto you. And you shall not eat of their flesh, and their carcasses you shall have indeed. Well, I don't know this. I'm reading the English. I don't like the English. Whatever has no fins nor scales in the waters, that is something that you, it's a tishaksu. It shall be abominable to you. Okay? So we know the characteristics of the fish. So that's clear. Then birds are mentioned. There are a list of birds. Let me just see if I can find some of this other stuff which amazed you before. Oh, well, here are the book. Scales and fins is all that it says. Does not say gills. So scales and fins. Yeah.
My question is, how did they know that non-kosher food is not good? And at the present time, proven, for example, pig, when you eat, you get a disease of the liver. When you eat a shellfish, you get hepatitis. When you are not circumcised, the lady gets cancer of the cervix. And all of those problems now is proven that when you do not eat, when you do, when told you do not eat non-kosher food, right now proven that causes problems. How did they know that time?
Very easy answer. I don't know. I absolutely don't know. And we'll read, I'm going to read to you in a while, we may get to it tonight, we may not, I'm going to read to you Maimonides on this subject. Don't want to go into it in too much detail, because the truth is we don't know the answers to these questions.
No, I mean, chicken, for example, when they palpate the ill, if it was broken, they say you should not eat. Now proven that because of tuberculosis, the chicken gets the broken bone, therefore tuberculosis causes problem after so many years.
It seems that maybe it's good. Maybe it's good. But let's hold off on that for a while, okay? Because we can't really answer it. We have here the Torah's first explanation, the first delineation of what is kosher. That's chapter 11 in Vayikra. And of course, Vayikra also, it's interesting, it doesn't say anything about health. No mention is made there. It doesn't say that that I want you to do it because it'll make you healthy. The only thing it says, toward the end here, says, "For I, the Lord your God, I am the Lord your God. Sanctify yourselves, therefore, and you shall be holy, for I am holy." It's the only real hard information we have. Right? It says, "Ki ani Hashem Elokechem, vihitkadishtem, you shall sanctify yourselves, vihiyitem kadoshim, and you shall be holy, ki kadosh ani, because I am holy." That's language which we will later have, later on in the book of Leviticus, in the parsha of Kedoshim. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. So that comes now at the tail end of all of this. It is somehow connected with holiness. It is connected with holiness. And then, I, the Lord your God, brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. Now, again, holy is Kodesh. This is all part of Kodoshim, of holy offerings. It is part of the temple system. And in fact, here, I think we should at least allow for the possibility that what we are reading about in Leviticus actually is the temple system. Right? The bringing of an offering at this particular point in time is directly connected with the bringing of something to the temple that you may enjoy the fruits of. You may enjoy part of the meat of it. I don't know, but I suspect very strongly that that discussion is exclusively centered on the temple. Exclusively. That is to say, the only way you could enjoy this offering was in the temple. It's the only option. Absolutely the only option. It is not until the 12th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. Right? 12th chapter of Deuteronomy. And just think of this time-wise. The book of Leviticus takes place, the setting up of the temple, of the Mishkan, is 1 year after the Exodus. Right? It's a year after the Exodus. The book of Deuteronomy takes place 40 years after the Exodus. Okay? Now, indeed, at the 1 year after the Exodus, it is true that the people at that point expected to go straight into the land of Israel. They were not condemned to wander in the desert for yet a little while. Eventually, they are condemned to wander in the desert because of the report of the spies and because of the reaction of the people. But they're condemned to wander then for 39 years, in effect, in the desert. Okay? So, at first, when these laws in Shemini were given in Leviticus, it's not as if they were that far away, time-wise, from going into the land of Israel. However, as things work themselves out, in fact, they were. And later on, at the end of the 40-year period of time, which is the book of Deuteronomy, the book says the following. This is Deuteronomy 12, verse 20. Ki yarchiv Hashem Elokecha et gvulcha. When the Lord your God shall enlarge your border, as he has promised you, and you shall say, I will eat flesh, because your soul desires eating flesh, you may eat the flesh according to the desire, to your desire. If the place which the Lord your God shall choose to put his name there shall be too far from where you are, then you shall kill of thy herd and thy flock which the Lord has given you, as I have commanded you. Let me read this to you in Hebrew. Ki yechak mincha makom, asher yivchar Hashem Elokecha lasum shemosha. So this is now dealing with the geographical reality that is going to happen once you go into the land of Israel. You may live in the Galilee and want to have steak for dinner. You are living too far from Jerusalem to be able to bring that offering and to benefit from it. It's just not practical. You don't have refrigeration. Okay? So you can't even put it in a, you know, to truck and bring it there and then slaughter it and bring it back to the Galilee. None of that is possible. So when that occurs, and you live too far away from the place which the Lord chooses. The conception here that there will be one spot, and the kodashim, the sanctified offerings, will be offered in that spot alone. Vizavachta, you shall lizboach, you shall slaughter. Zivicha, same word that's used for the offering. You shall go through that process of ritual slaughter, mibecharcha umitzoncha, from your cattle or from your sheep, asher natan Hashem lecha, which the Lord has given to you, kasher tzibiticha, as I have commanded you. as I have commanded you.
Huh? Before.
Well, the question is, what does that mean?
Can you say the part about makom again?
Okay.
Like the key part, right?
Well, when the place which the Lord has chosen will be too far for you. Alright? You shall slaughter mibekarcha umitzoncha, from your cattle or from your sheep, asher natan hashem lecha, which the Lord has given to you, kasher tzivitecha, as in the way that I have commanded you. So where did the Lord come from this?
Where did it come from?
Probably it was back there in the book of Leviticus. But then again, the truth is we don't get any laws of slaughtering there. It says you shall slaughter the sacrifices. Yeah. It doesn't say how. Here it says, Ka'asher as tziviticha, as I commanded you. Oh, remember I started off by telling you that there's a written law and there's an oral law? Right? As I commanded you in the oral law. In the oral law. Right? How do you know what that is? You know that by reading the Talmud of Chulin. Okay? You got it. The laws of slaughter go back to Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses on Mount Sinai. All of this is what is referred to here. This is the slaughter of chulin, per se, of those animals that you will consume for your own enjoyment outside of the temple. That is, by definition, what we mean by chulin. Okay? Question.
Well, is there no other emphasis on makom, on the distance, when we're talking about the Mishkan?
What do you mean?
When we're living in the time of the Mishkan,
right?
Is it assumed that we're all near enough?
The Mishkan, yes.
Okay.
Because the
so
Mishkan was near enough.
If we start talking about distance, then shouldn't we know from that very mention that it already must be post-Mishkan time?
Well, this is preparation for that. Because you're about to go in the land of Israel in the book of Deuteronomy. You're at the threshold of the land. Moses is going to die shortly.
It's not so crazy that it should be...
No, it sounds like good preparation. It sounds like the right way to do it.
No,
it sounds like the right time to get this stuff out there. Right? The people are maybe wondering, what are we going to do when we get that land? It's such a good deal. Right? We're going to be scattered. We're going to be able to go to the Galilee. What is this? If we can't have steak for dinner. Hamburgers.
Yes.
Sacrificial
slaughter are clear.
No. What do you mean by clear? They're clearly in the Talmud. Yes, they're in the oral.
They too are in the oral. That's
correct.
So
yes.
Both, so we know that they differ because of two oral traditions, or are they?
We're dependent entirely on the oral tradition. Whatever it is, it's dependent entirely on the oral tradition.
Both.
Because in both. Because there's very little written material describing the details. Okay?
Second question. Okay,
go ahead.
I've always tried to picture the sacrifices and what was going on the Temple Mount. And I think of it as this enormous barbecue. I mean, it must have smelled like a great barbecue going on because they were grilling meat all
yep.
the time, right?
Yep. Well, there wasn't much blood to smell, to tell you the truth, because the blood was not burnt.
When they put it on the altar, isn't that the same altar?
No, the blood is not put on the altar. And the blood is put on the altar, the blood is not burned on the altar, it is poured. It's a what?
Lakiz
is to pour it out. It's to pour it out, and then it runs down through a pipe system, basically. And it drains into some drains that they had on the Temple Mount. So, but it is not burnt. It is not burnt. The only thing that is burnt is actual flesh. And a certain amount of the fat.
Shabbat, like
excuse me?
What days did they do the burnt sacrifice?
7 days a week.
Including Shabbat?
7 days a week.
The fire was done for
yeah.
the fire.
Yeah. Burnt offering done 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Yeah.
So they could like
You bet. You bet. We used to. I was going. We. In your. Correct. That's what it smelled like. Well, you had other types of smells, but I'm sure that was the dominant smell. We used to have, in my experience, we used to go for many, many years. We would go up to Franconia National Park, and all the national parks, well, at least Franconia, used to have outside one barbecue place after another. And so you would go toward the park, and it's, you know, Texas, this, and a lot of the national parks out there, if you have been to the West is like that too. You go out to the park, and you know, before you get there are all the motels and the places where people eat. And in America, people want to have meat. It's America. It's the nature of that country out there. We're a little weird where we live here. We have some other interests. But in America, they want to have roasted meats. Everybody eats meat. And they eat on the barbecue. Where would Lyndon Johnson eat? Inside. You eat on the barbecue. So that's where everybody wants to eat. So you go toward the national park, and it was like going to the Temple Mount. The smell of all this burning flesh, that's what it was like.
The tree.
In the park is tree. We'll get to tree in a minute, by the way.
Two questions. Question number one is in regard to the last issue. So if I live in Jerusalem, I'm not living far away in the Galilee. That means every offering is a Kodesh offering.
Well, that's an interesting question. Correct. Once you set up this system, in fact, it becomes an independent system. But it seems from what we're reading here as if it couldn't be independent. But in fact, it does end up being an independent system. Whether what really happened, I couldn't tell you, because I just don't know.
Question number two is to the beginning of this meeting. You mentioned in Zayin that only in the land of Israel it was really actually observed, and the rule did not apply in other parts of the world. Then you said Moadim, which is the holy days, but the Jewish calendar is basically on the northern part of the equator, because that's our weather and our the way the calendar was established. So why Jews who live in Australia need to practice it? They should be relieved of it, because it's completely opposite. They cannot bring offering in Shavuot, which is the middle of the winter then.
Because everything depends on the land of Israel. We all do what happens.
But we don't do Zayin.
Doesn't matter. Our calendar is set. We said last week on Shmini Atzeret, we said the prayer for rain. And those of you who are here, remember what was doing outside. It was raining. In New York, we had several days of rain last week. And we needed more rain like we needed a hole in the head. And so what did we say? Prayer for rain. So why do we say a prayer for rain? We said a prayer for rain because our mind is on rain in the land of Israel. So all of those things recall for us the reality, geographical.
Why not if it's in our mind?
Because the law limited certain things to the law of the land of Israel, such as Shemitah, for example, the laws of Shemitah. That you have to let the land lie fallow every seventh year. That does not apply in Australia. Only applies within the borders of the land of Israel.
Now, the Talmud really address it and distinguish, or that was practical?
Well, no, it's all addressed in the Talmud. All addressed there.
You just said the
go ahead.
The food that was sacrificed, the animals that were sacrificed, was food for the Eleni.
Plus, sometimes it was food for the people themselves, the Shlamim were.
How are they allowed to make the fire and do it on Shabbos and eat it?
Mm-hmm. Because the Torah permits it. And the Torah permits the fire to be burning in the temple, only in the temple. And where the Torah tells us what goes on in the temple, then it's permissible to do it in the temple. It cannot be done outside the temple, but it can be done in the temple. Okay? Now that's not to say that the Kohanim could do anything they wanted. Because when I said that meat was burning on the altar on Shabbat, that doesn't necessarily mean that you could do anything you wanted on the altar on Shabbat, even in the temple. Rather, what I was referring to was the daily offering. There must be a morning offering and a mincha and an afternoon offering. It's called the tamid. That offering was brought every single day, 365 days of the year. In the morning, the Kohen would slaughter the offering, would bring it up, and if it was a festival, there would be additional offerings, musaf offerings, that had to be brought. Those who brought Sabbath and no Sabbath didn't make any difference. Other things which were discretionary could not be brought. So it's not as if the Kohen could act completely differently. Okay? But in those areas where the offerings were to gods, that happened 365 days a year. Okay? Now, there are a few other things that we should remember were also relevant in the laws of Kashrut, which are in various places in the Torah. One we mentioned just before, and that is laws concerning blood. All right? Blood is... we are not allowed to eat the blood. And you know that, or I hope you know that kosher meat is not only the meat of an animal that is a kosher animal, which we described here. Number one, it has to be the meat of a kosher animal. Number two, it has to be slaughtered ka'asher tziviticha, as I have commanded you. So it has to be properly slaughtered. Thirdly, assuming that, and we'll get to the details of that in a moment, in addition to that, the blood of the animal has to be drained out of it. Has to be drained out of it. And in addition to that, whatever blood remains has to be salted and then washed. Okay? In order to, because salt is an attracting agent for blood, the salt has to be placed on the meat. That's the most common way in which it's done, although there are other ways to do it. You can actually broil a piece of liver, for example. You can't really, liver is so filled with blood that liver can only be eaten when broiled. Okay? So there is the additional aspect of the blood is part of the laws of Kashrut. And one piece of that actually goes back to this week's Parsha that we're going to read on Saturday. This week's Parsha that we will read on Saturday has a very small reference made to it about the slaughtering of animals. A very interesting little piece. It's later understood in rabbinic law to be what we call Eiver Min HaChai. Eiver Min HaChai. Find it to Parsha Noach. Here it is. Chapter 9 of Genesis is a radical break with what we read in last week's Parsha. Last week's Parsha, very important to remember, that Adam and Eve were allowed to eat all of the fruits of the Garden of Eden with the exception of the products of two trees. Okay? That was the beginning and the end of what they were permitted to eat. That is to say, in the story that we read about the Garden of Eden, human beings were only permitted to eat vegetables and fruits. Ever think about that? So that the initial permission, or the state of nature, as we have it in Genesis, is a state of nature where people are vegetarians. It isn't until this week's Parsha, which is part of a degeneration of the human condition. And then finally, of wiping out the human beings and of the creation of a new reality, which is post-flood, which seems to take into account some of the evil that's inherent in human nature. It's only at that point that God says in the beginning of chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air, upon all wherewith the ground teemeth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. First time we see that in the Torah. Only it's post-diluvian. After the flood. Every moving thing that liveth shall be food for you. Kol remes asher hu chai lachem yiel ochla. Ki yerek esev natati lachem et kol. They are like the green herbs that I have given to you. All of the living things are given to you. So that here, all are given to you. So in this pre-kashrut, all of the animals are now given to human beings to eat. Then it says, Ach basar benafsho damo lo tochel. That's verse 4. Only flesh, now here the English translation says, flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat. It's very hard to know what this means. I'll translate it word by word. Ach basar benafsho. But meat binafsho, which is still living, damo lo tochelo, its blood you shall not eat. So there are different ways to understand this. One is the very first instance of the prohibition against the consumption of blood. And as I said to you, remember now that when we get to the sacrificial system later on, blood cannot be consumed. The blood goes to God. Because it's the life. It's the nefesh. And all things connected with blood are life, and only God is the source of life. Therefore, it has to be returned to God. If you're going to get any enjoyment, you cannot have the blood, because the blood is identified with the holiness of the life. That goes to God. Right? It's simply rendered back to you. Here, this is the source of one of the 7 Noahide commandments. There are, understood in chapter 9 of Genesis, commandments that apply to all human beings, universal laws. One of them is this one in verse 4, which is called Eber Min Achai, taking the limb of a living animal. Right? We believe that no human being is permitted, not no Jew, but no human being is permitted to take the limb of a living animal and eat it. So that too is part of the laws of Kashrut, the laws of Eber Min Achai, but it extends a little bit beyond that. And it's actually an issue. It's an issue. It's an issue for people. It was told to me most poignantly by our congregant Terry Krolich, who fairly frequently goes to Japan. And she has scientific meetings in Japan, colleagues that she works with in Japan. And any of you who have traveled in the Far East know, one of the ways that you can get along, or you try to get along, some people try to get along, is with eating fish. And she found to her amazement that the Japanese serve live fish. Because they believe that it's so good to get it right off the fish. And so they serve to the table, she said she had the experience, that they serve to the table a live fish, which then one was supposed to cut off the fish and you eat it immediately. All right? That's Eber Min Achai. Eber Min Achai. Okay? So here, that is another aspect of the laws of Kashrut. The final aspect of the laws of Kashrut, which we have not mentioned, which is one that you are very familiar with, and that is that you shall not conceive a kid in its mother's milk. It is the prohibition against milk and meat being cooked or being eaten together. Okay, they're actually two different things, being cooked and being eaten together. So that is the sort of the scope of the laws of Kashrut. Excuse me, and the Tractate of Chulin includes discussions of all of those areas of the law. In fact, it goes way beyond that. The first two chapters deal with the laws of Shechita. Okay, we will look at those. I want you to see the bases of the laws of Shechita, of ritual slaughtering. Today was in contact with a shochet, and I will have a guest lecture also, but with a shochet. I think that it would be helpful for all of us to learn from somebody who does this professionally, because this is a profession, and the shochtim really understand these laws better than any of us. And you can read about it, but until you actually handle the animal and you have the experience of regularly doing this, I think you really can't understand it. So those of us, as much as, you know, I'm sort of the intellectual type, I've never shechted an animal. So I want to invite a shochet to be able to share with us the details of what it is that a shochet does. So I think that I have a yes from a shochet, who's a very interesting fellow, and another few weeks, once I can make that arrangement with him, he will come and give us a lecture on Shechita from the Shochet's point of view. Okay? So that's the first two chapters involve that. The third chapter involves the subject of Trefa. Now, Trefa in the Tractate of Chulin doesn't mean what it means in regular Jewish parlance. When we say something is treif, what does that mean?
It's
not kosher, right? It's not kosher. That's not what it means in the Talmud. In the Talmud, what it means is that something that is treif, when the shochet examines the animal has had some defect which could have been responsible for its death. So there is some problem that the animal has had. Either the animal has had it as a result of being attacked from another animal, or it's caught a disease, or it's an anatomical anomaly of birth, which is also possible. That is the definition of trefa in the Talmud. Trefa literally means torn. An animal that's torn. And therefore what it means is the animal was attacked by another animal in all likelihood. But it's then used, the definition is borrowed, to mean anything that could have killed the animal. All right? The fourth chapter is a very interesting chapter. Intellectually, it's a fascinating study of laws that pertain to the fetus of the slaughtered animal. Because the question here is, if you shecht an animal that's pregnant, have you shechted the fetus? Is the fetus a separate animal, or is the fetus the same animal? As you can imagine, that chapter has tremendous ramifications practically, even in terms today, in terms of abortion laws, for example. To what extent do we consider the fetus to be the mother, or is the fetus an independent being? Those discussions have their source here in Masechet Chulin, because they come from the laws of Shechita. And we need to know when you've shechted an animal whether you have in fact technically shechted the fetus as well.
It's a matter too. It's a legal issue if you killed a pregnant woman.
Correct. Whether you committed two murders or one. Okay. So that goes back now to Masechet Chulin. This goes back to Masechet Chulin. The fifth chapter is a chapter that deals with animals, but that is an ethical chapter. It deals with the Torah's prohibition against slaughtering an animal and its child on the same day. You remember that law in the Torah? The Torah says that you cannot slaughter an animal and its child on the same day. So the fifth chapter of Chulin deals entirely with that subject. Okay? The sixth, with the obligation to cover the blood of a slaughtered chaya. A chaya is different than the behemah. A chaya is an animal that is a non-domesticated. It is normally not domesticated.
You would call it a wilder chaya.
But it's not necessarily a wilder chaya. And the key example, there are really, the main example is the deer.
Or the chicken.
No, the deer, the chicken is... that's different. Yes, I'll get to that now. I was going to get to that in a second. But the mammal that is the chaya, is the deer. The deer is a chaya. And deer is a kosher animal. Venison. You can have kosher venison. We had, for example, in New York, when Lavana's restaurant was open. Did anybody eat in Lavana's? Terrific restaurants, great. Unfortunately, she went out of business. I had Lavana on my radio program. She comes in one day. I would invite her once a year to the radio program because I love Lavana. She's such a character. She's good to have on the radio. She says, "Rabbi Wexler." She's a very animated kind of person. So that was a family restaurant. Lavana's on the west side. So one day she comes in. She says, "The Rabbi Wexler, bad news." So what's the matter, Lavana? She says, the restaurant is closing. I said, "Why are you closing the restaurant?" She says, "Rent." "You heard of rent?" She says, "They killed my business. The rent, the landlord, they ran it."
By the building.
Anyway, so they went out of business. So, but one of the beautiful things about that restaurant was that there were two things that you could, in my experience, I only tasted there. I never tasted anywhere else. One is venison, the other is buffalo.
Well, you can get buffalo in that.
You can get buffalo? Where do you get buffalo?
Kosher marketplace.
I never had buffalo before. I had it in Lavana's. And venison, can you get venison anywhere else today?
You probably could.
They were venison. The deer is considered a chaya, a kosher chaya. And the Torah says, when you slaughter such an animal, you have to cover the blood. The blood has to be covered. We will see that that also applies to fowl, to chicken. The law applies also for the slaughtering of chickens. The blood has to be covered. Okay? So, let's see. The seventh chapter is then, I'm looking here, is the Gidon Asher. You remember the story of Jacob. After Jacob fights with the angel, he wakes up in the morning and he has struggled with the angel. And then it says that you are never allowed to eat the hind sinew, the sinew of the thigh. And therefore that, whatever that is, has to be removed. You're not allowed to eat it. We're not allowed to eat it. So one chapter of Chulin deals entirely with that. The eighth chapter is the obligation to give the foreleg. No, the eighth chapter is milk and meat. The ninth chapter is the ritual impurity of foods and animal carcasses. The tenth chapter with the shearlings of the flock that you have to cut and give to the temple, the first of the shearlings of the sheep, when you shear a sheep. Let's see, the 12th chapter is the prohibition of taking a nest and a bird together with its eggs. All right, the same thing as the animal, the mother animal and the baby animal. So that is the scope then of Masechet Chulin. It deals not only with the laws of Kashrut, but it deals with all those areas of the law that pertain to animals. Okay? Whether they be the ethical areas of the law that pertain to animals, if that's what's involved, or areas of ritual impurity that are related also to animals, or specifically the wide variety of issues which we articulated today that are related to the kashrut of animals. Okay? Question or two?
Is there in any of those chapters cover if the animal feels pain, the humane side of dealing with animals?
From time to time you will get Tsar Balei Chaim is also a law of the Torah, and that appears in several places, not principally in this Masechet. The Tsar Balei Chaim is a law of the Torah that we are commanded to be concerned about an animal's pain. Whether the laws of slaughtering are related to that issue,
yeah, that's why I'm asking.
That you will not see here. You will see that in later literature. When we get to read, I'll look at Maimonides next week. You'll see that Maimonides makes reference to that. Yes.
How can you take off pig as a swine animal, get such a center stage of abomination? I mean, the ultimate trait.
That's another subject. That's another.
It falls into that category like all the others, of priest
or shaman. Correct.
But it was domesticated.
That's a sociological question.
It is.
In fact, a sociological question. By sociological, it has to do, I'm sure, with history. With the history of the Jews, with the use of the pig in other societies, including Roman society. So, I think that's a different question. That is not why the pig is considered to be so repugnant. Is not something that we read about in the Talmud. Did I see it? Yes.
Are there any Talmudic roots to this contemporary issue that has arisen recently about that's tied into kashrut, that part of kashrut should be the ethical treatment of animals and how they're farmed and how they are raised?
The shochet that I'm hoping to bring to you is involved in eco kashrut. Is one of these shochtim, Eco Kashrut, is one of these shochtim who is particularly concerned about the animals, so this is his vantage point. I hope also during the year of my colleague, Rabbi Adler from Minnesota, is in town. I want to invite him. He's the one who has, in the conservative movement, there is a movement today that is very centered on this, and he's the one who started the whole thing. So I would like to have him come and talk with you about it. From some of the things that I've said, I think that you begin to get a sense that the lines between the holiness of animals, and animals are special, that you just don't kill animals. Some of the other issues we've mentioned here, and we might even begin to speculate. It's natural to speculate why all these laws. Why all? I don't want to spend the year focusing on that particularly, but from time to time we'll come back to it. And I think that it's inevitable that we will want to think about how does the larger system work? And what is really happening here? So hopefully we'll have some particular insights from some of the people who are working in this field as well. Okay? We continue next week. We shall do the first Mishnah, and we will read the Gemara that follows. Just a word about next week, by the way. Jay, did anyone send around a list of names? You had a list? There's some new people who are here for the first time. Next week, I'm going to be coming back to New York on Wednesday. I have a flight that should make me back here with no problems. You know from travel these days, sometimes you just don't know what. If, God forbid, I should have a problem, I will check in with you, and we would have to cancel the class. But there's no reason why that should happen unless something crazy happens. It's all set up so that I have plenty of time, and we'll be here hours and hours in advance. Oh, you might want to look at this. It's an illuminated bullet, right?
Question that you mentioned a little bit personal.